Good evening and welcome behind the news for January 15, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And I've got two interviews scheduled for tonight. First, about 10 minutes after the hour, Archie Piotti, who is a lawyer with the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, about U.S. asylum policy. You may have seen the front page story in the New York Times, key to a release of a report from the Lawyers Committee. Archie Piotti is a lawyer who's deeply involved in their work of defending asylum seekers who are treated very badly by the land of the free. And then at the bottom of the hour, I will speak with Satya Gabriel, who is an economist teaching at Mount Holyoke College, about the Chinese economy, an overview of what's going on there, how real the boom is, whether actual people are benefiting from it, distribution of income, and what the historical and global implications are of China's rapid growth and emergence as a major economic power on the world scene. Before we get to our first interview, first of all, just an announcement. Jennifer Baumgardner, who is a feminist writer, has been on this show a couple of times, announces a campaign to amplify the voices of women who've had abortions. The campaign will kick off with I'm Not Sorry Day, a week from today, January 22, 2004, a recasting of the Roe v. Wade anniversary. Big campaign, and in New York, that's going to be observed at Blue Stockings Bookstore, 172 Allen Street, between Rivington and Stanton. That's Lower East Side, just a little bit below Houston Street. Blue Stockings Bookstore, 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. The director of the film, I'm Not Sorry, will be at the store talking about the film. T-shirts, resource kits will be available. Then again, that's a week from tonight, January 22nd, at Blue Stockings Bookstore, 172 Allen Street, between Rivington and Stanton, 7 to 8:30 p.m. I'm Not Sorry Day to commemorate the anniversary of Roe v. Wade. And in the economic news, the ABC News Money Magazine Consumer Comfort Index, which we've been keeping close tabs on this show, a weekly reading of how individuals feel about their own personal finances and the national economy, a measure of their optimism or pessimism, was unchanged last week at minus 7, which is sort of a middling reading, but up considerably from its lows last September of around minus 20. It's actually slightly above its historical average, which is kind of odd that it's in negative territory, but that's the way they constructed the thing. But it does look like consumers are reporting somewhat better personal finances and somewhat better evaluations of the national economy. The weekly tally of first-time applicants for unemployment insurance, a very timely and important indicator of the state of the job market, that indicator fell by 11,000 last week, meaning 11,000 fewer people were signing up for unemployment insurance. And the number continuing to draw benefits fell by 128,000. And these numbers are the lowest in a couple of years. So it's looking like the labor market is finally picking up after a long stagnation. But you certainly couldn't tell that by the employment report that was released last week, last Friday morning. This is certainly one of the most important of all the regular economic indicators to come out of the U.S. government. The headline number was just 1,000 new jobs created in the month of December, way below what most analysts were expecting, including me. I was on the low end of expectations, but they still surprised me with an even more negative number than even the most pessimistic among us had expected. That is just an absolutely terrible number. Just in a normal month, we could expect over 200,000 jobs, or normal, that is, before the recent period of jobless recovery. Here's one way to look at just how weak the numbers were. In the last 3 months of last year, Canada created 173,000 new jobs. The U.S., with a workforce eight times as large, created just 144,000. That is almost 30,000 fewer than Canada, a country with one-eighth the size of the labor force as ours. If we had done as well as our northern neighbor in December, we'd have added 443,000 jobs instead of the 1,000 that we did. Factory employment. Manufacturing employment has declined for 41 consecutive months, a streak with no historical parallel. Manufacturing employment is off almost 18% over the last almost 6 years. It peaked in March 1998, which is well before the broad economy peaked, and has been, well, mostly dropped for 98, 99, but we've now in a streak of 41 consecutive months, something we've never, ever seen before. The monthly employment numbers began in 1939, so it's pretty certain that we saw a similar streak at the beginning of the 1930s depression, but in modern history, we've seen nothing like this. The average work week also declined by about 12 minutes, which is a very weak performance. Usually, if a job market is about to turn up, average weekly hours turn up first before employers started hiring new workers. So this is a very bad sign. The total number of hours worked, that is, the average hours worked times the number of people working, a measure of the total aggregate labor effort in the U.S. economy, in the private service sector fell by 0.6%, one of the worst performances in nearly 40 years of histories for this indicator. And average hourly earnings also turned in another terrible performance, just up 0.2%, and real wages now, that is after inflation, are either zero or less. This is looking less and less like a month anomaly, which is a lot of analysts were looking at it as, and looking more like a trend. That is, we saw a very broad decline in real hourly wages between 1973 and 1995, a rise that gained back some about half of that loss between in the late 1990s and into early part of the new millennium, but now it's stalled or about to head down again. So the U.S. Working class not doing too well. And just another measure of how bad things are in the job market. We have the share of the adult population working. The employment population ratio, as economists call it, is at the lowest level in over 8 years. If we were having a normal recovery, according to the official measures, we're now 25 months into an economic expansion. The recession officially ended November 2001, and now we have 25 months of employment data since then. And if it had been behaving according to the long-term averages, we would be have over 8 million people working who aren't working right now. So this is, even though the unemployment rate never went up too high in this recession, the failure of the job market to expand is remarkable, even compared to the jobless recovery of the early 1990s. That was mild in comparison to the stagnation we've seen in the job market the last couple of years. And that may be turning. Certainly the behavior of the jobless claims numbers is suggesting that, and other indicators are suggesting that, but it hasn't turned yet. And then just a couple of other notes. The Physicians for a National Health Program sent out a press release on a new study by researchers at Harvard Medical School and Public Citizen, published in tomorrow's issue of the International Journal of Health Services, finds that the healthcare bureaucracy cost the U.S. almost $400 billion. The study estimates that national health insurance could save at least $286 billion annually on paperwork, enough to cover all the uninsured, to provide full prescription drug coverage for everyone in the United States. The study was based on the most comprehensive analysis to date of health administration spending. A couple of highlights. The $286 billion savings that we could see with national health insurance would offset the cost of covering all the uninsured, cover all out-of-pocket prescription drug costs for seniors as well as those under 65, fund retraining and job placement programs for insurance workers and others who would lose their jobs under a national health insurance scheme, and would make substantial improvements in coverage and quality of care. Looked at another way, the potential administrative savings are equivalent to $6,940 for each of the 41 million people uninsured in the United States, more than enough to pay for their health coverage. So it's everyone thinks that the public sector is inefficient, the private sector is efficient, but that's often not the case, and it's especially not the case when it comes to our private healthcare system, which is a riot of administrative cost and duplicated efforts and overhead and supervision and expensive and often very bad care. So the hard numbers are that we could save money and still cover everyone, that doesn't seem to be on the table, politically speaking, right now, but it would be a very, very good idea. And now we're joined on the line by Archie Piotti, who is an attorney with the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, which seems to be in the process of changing its name to Human Rights First. But they've released a report called In Liberty's Shadow, U.S. Detention of Asylum Seekers in the Era of Homeland Security, which you can get on their website. And for the celebrity interest angle, it's got a foreword by Sigourney Weaver. And welcome to WBAI, Archie Piotti.
Thank you very much. Hi, how are you?
Thanks for joining us. This name change to Human Rights First is not complete, or is we in transition here?
We're in transition. It's been going on for a little while. This month is finally, I think, the end of it. We are going to become Human Rights First this month.
Okay. And your website for people who want to get this report, what is that now?
That's www.lchr.org. And you can still access our website despite the name change at that address.
Okay, I'll repeat. This is the end of the show.
Thank you.
The United States likes to think of itself as a welcoming to immigrants and foreigners of all kinds.
That's right. Sees
itself as a beacon of freedom to the world.
Mm-hmm.
How are we treating people who are seeking political asylum here?
Well, for those who are coming to the United States to look for asylum and arrive at the U.S. borders, if they don't have proper documents, if they don't have proper entry documents, or even if they have good documents but they ask for asylum, they end up being taken to detention mandatorily. Detention is a nice word for being held in a prison, in a prison-like condition, I suppose one could say, anywhere near a large airport. Here in New York, it's near the JFK airport. And when they get to detention, they're there indefinitely. In other words, it's not like getting a prison sentence. If you commit a crime, you can only serve 6 months or less or 2 years or less. In this situation, you can be detained for 7 years. There are people who've been detained for as long as 7 years is right here in New York.
Has it always been such, or has this been a nastier turn in American policy?
Well, this is something that started in 1996 when the laws actually changed to have mandatory detention. That has been going on, you know, for 8 years now. But since September 11th happened, and also since the change to Department of Homeland Security, we've actually seen a slight increase in changes that affect asylum seekers. One big difference is nationality-based detention. In other words, there have been several different policies that have come through that affect people from certain countries more than others. Haitians, for example, have been the subject of much, much tighter detention policies and less frequent release from detention. Another problem that we've seen is that people who are detained are not being released on parole. In other words, once you end up in detention, if you're asking for asylum, you should be able, after a week or so, you have an initial credibility screening, you should be able to be released on parole. The INS, long ago, and the Department of Justice created guidelines that said, you know, we favor the release of asylum seekers on parole as long as they have somewhere to go and they don't present a security risk. And oddly enough, since September 11th, it seems that getting asylum seekers out on parole, even when they have, you know, wonderful community ties, they have their own passports in some cases, they've committed no crimes, they present no security risk, they're not let out on parole all over the country now. That's a big change that we're seeing.
Let's step back to the World War II era. There was a famous case of a ship full of mostly Jewish refugees from the Nazis,
mm-hmm.
and that didn't get a very warm welcome, and that caused something of a rethink after the war in U.S. policy, right?
Right. That was the St. Louis back in 1939, I think. That was definitely we saw a shift after that boatload of people. In the United States, in the aftermath of that, was one of the first countries to instigate the creation of the Refugee Convention, United Nations Convention for Refugees, which internationally is one of the largest, one of the conventions, one of the treaties with the largest number of signatories onto it. And basically, you know, we got this going. We said, you know, because the people flee, because people are in danger of persecution, we should, all of us should agree to open our doors and open our shores to people who suffer from political repression, persecution based on their religion, whatever it might be, and these people have always enjoyed that right that also was created under other international treaties. Unfortunately, over the years, you know, with immigration laws tightening, the United States has been at the forefront of tight immigration laws, and we've had mandatory detention, like I said, for many years. And our borders have really tightened in the last few months, ever since the Department of Homeland Security came up.
Now, let's go back to the era when things were a little looser. Was the asylum granted more or less equally, or were, say, refugees from the Soviet Union treated better than refugees from a repressive state in Latin America?
You mean years ago?
Yeah, years ago.
Well, in the beginning, the convention, actually, the treaty only covered people from European nations in the very beginning, years and years ago. And then somewhere in the 70s, I believe, or no, sorry, in the late 60s, the convention was changed with a protocol to include refugees coming from any country. United States, our own immigration laws over the years in the 70s grew to, you know, accept refugees from any country as long as they were applying because they were being persecuted by their government or someone the government couldn't control on account of something, some characteristic of theirs that they couldn't change, like a political opinion, national origin, race, these sorts of things, religion. And we haven't always been in favor more of people from, you know, European countries or Soviet Union countries versus countries people from Africa, for example. There wasn't always a trend like that. It's more in the recent years that we've seen certain people from certain countries face increased difficulties, and that would be since 9/11, people coming from Arab and Muslim countries, as well as Haitians in the last few months.
I want to get back to this in a moment, but what is the state of international law on refugees, and what kind of treaties is the U.S. party to, and what are our obligations under those treaties?
The treaties are obviously the, as I said, the Refugee Convention, and then there's protocol several years later. And our obligations, we're signed on quite fully. There are several little pieces that we've removed ourselves from, but the basic substance of the treaty, you know, we have to abide by, and that means we accept people at the border. One of the only things in the treaty that no state, no country can say, I definitely, you know, don't want to abide by this part, is something called non-refoulement, which means I cannot turn somebody away from my border if they're asking me for help. And that's, you know, it's an incredibly important premise of the Refugee Convention. And that stands, that's binding on anybody who signed, and that includes us. The other thing to keep in mind is that there's the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the UDHR, which is considered to be at the very base of international law. It's like that sine qua non, that thing without which we wouldn't have human rights law in the world. And one of the provisions within that Universal Declaration is that, you know, someone should have the right to seek and enjoy asylum in a country of their choosing. And we have that here. We have to abide by that. That is an obligation upon us. There's also the International Covenant for Civil and Political Rights, which we are a signatory to, which requires us to treat people of different races and, you know, different religions, et cetera, different national origins as well, in a non-discriminatory manner. Any policies we have here, whether they be foreigners or you know, our own citizens, should not be treated differently simply because of their race or where they're coming from. So these are all, you know, these are the sort of basic international treaties that create the very fundamental principles of international human rights law. And we're a member to this. This is all binding on us. And the only way that this can really be enforced is by us having our own domestic laws come in line and our own domestic practice come in line with these treaties. And our laws are not in line, but more importantly, our practice veers very far away from how we could actually be protecting refugees. If we abided by our own guidelines to release refugees when they come here, we would not be in violation of yet another principle of refugee protection, which is not to penalize someone who comes here seeking protection and doesn't have good documents. I mean, it makes logical sense.
It's not like a government you're escaping from is going to give you your proper documentation.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, if you're in your home country and somebody says to you, you know, the government's coming after you and the police are chasing you and you've been imprisoned for 6 years and tortured brutally by the security forces, I mean, what is the chance that you're going to go ask for a passport? I mean, it doesn't work like that. So people often find themselves very, very, very forced to go seek protection, you know, to get on a plane, to get on a boat, to do whatever they have to do to get here and ask for protection. And they don't have documents, and we're not allowed to punish them for that, and yet they find themselves in prison.
Yeah, the legal principle is you can't turn people away from the border, but if you, once you admit them, throw them into jail for 3 years. Is that in accordance with international law?
No, no. As I was saying, we should not be punishing. That's another article in the convention, the Refugee Convention. We should not punish people for coming without good documents, and putting somebody in detention, in a jail-like facility. The one here in New York, for example, is it's basically a warehouse in the cargo area of JFK Airport that has no windows, and it has no real meaningful outdoor recreation. It has a room with a steel grid on top of it. It doesn't really have a library. It doesn't have, meaningful access to any sort of real visitation with family and friends. I mean, it's in a lot of ways worse than a regular prison. And these are the places where we're incarcerating people who are coming here asking for help. And this is, in the last 2 years, it's been about 16,000 people have come asking for help at the border and been subject to what is known as expedited removal, another 1996 law, which says that if you don't make, if you don't make it clear to an officer at the border in a language that the officer can understand somehow that, you are scared to go home and you will be in danger if you return to your home country, if you don't make that clear, they'll send you right back to your home country. And that is, again, like I said, something very similar to refoulement, just to sending someone right back home to where they've come from when they're in danger.
I'm speaking with Archie Piotti, who is with the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, now renaming itself Human Rights First.
That's right.
And I think you said also international law, you're not supposed to discriminate by country of origin.
That's right.
Of course, the United States is discriminating by country of origin in mm-hmm. practice, mainly against people from predominantly Arab or Muslim countries. And you also said Haitians.
That's right.
I understand the logic, as ugly it is the first part, but what is it about Haitians that's so threatening?
Yeah, it's a good question. Unfortunately, the only guidance, some of the only guidance we have comes from a very monumental case that was decided a few months ago called In Re DJ, which stands for David Joseph, a young man from Haiti who is detained in Miami, and he's still there now for about 2 years, been living in detention. Now, what happened was he came over here on a boat with a large number of other people and was put in detention. He had an uncle close by who, wanted to have him come out, and they filed for a bond hearing. And it's somewhat complicated why he was eligible for one and not anybody else who comes in, but it's for a legal reason he could apply for bond. And he did apply for bond and was granted bond, but the government appealed. And at the second level, at the second level, the government again, the appeals, Immigration Appeals Board, granted him bond again and said this young man should be released to the care of his uncle who can pay the bond amount. Now, the government requested, this is the Department of Homeland Security now, requested John Ashcroft, our Attorney General, to reconsider the decision made by the Immigration Court and the Board of Immigration Appeals. And when the Attorney General reconsidered in his decision, he said that he didn't want David Joseph to be released on bond, and nobody in a similar circumstance could be released on bond. And the reason he gave was that it's a threat to our national security. This is based on two principles that John Ashcroft relied on, one being that it's possible that, Coast Guard resources that are being used to escort asylum seekers on boats from Haiti to intercept these boats and to interdict them and take them home, those Coast Guard resources should be not used for this but used for national security purposes. Therefore, we should not be letting somebody like David Joseph, seek asylum and be free while seeking asylum in this country. I'm not really sure how Coast Guard resources correlates to this young man being detained for 2 years, but this was the logic that was used by John Ashcroft. Another point that he made was that people who want to come here to commit terrorist acts, say from, one of the countries that the United States government suspects of harboring al-Qaeda-type terrorists, might come over to Haiti and use that as a staging ground for them reaching the United States shores. This is, of course, not a principle that's founded on any sort of, evidence or reality. And the State Department itself came out and said that we have nothing that points to that as being a logical or a realistic proposition.
God, that's awful. You've got a couple, several stories in this report, just gruesome stories, like a couple of Ukrainians who are certainly, you know, Ukraine is not thought of as a source of terrorism. How are these guys treated?
Ukraine is not a source of terrorism. In fact, after the Soviet Union fell, these gentlemen, you know, were very hopeful and took the opportunity to start a non-governmental organization to help victims of Chernobyl, young women and young children who were disabled and were not getting funding from the government for medical care. This is what they were doing. Now, their activities were perceived as being anti-government, and, the security forces came after them and targeted them and beat them and pursued them and jailed them for some period of time. After all this, they managed to get out of the Ukraine, after several couple of years of all of this going on. Really, really afraid for their lives and the lives of their families, they made their way after a long, arduous journey here to the United States. When they arrived in JFK, they actually didn't mean to come to the United States, but they were sent here by another country and another airport. And when they got here, they immediately went to the immigration desk and said, we're here to seek political asylum. We're scared. We've been hurt. We need help. And they were taken directly to a detention center. Contrary to a lot of other people's stories, many people say that at the border when they get here, they're handcuffed, they're shackled to benches. We've chronicled some of these stories as well. Victor and Alexei, our two Ukrainian friends, clients, came in and said that, the immigration guys were pretty nice to them. They said, well, let's take you somewhere where you can take a shower and we'll give you a place to stay for a few weeks while we help you to see if you can get asylum. Meanwhile, they were handcuffed and put into a van and brought to the detention center. And their clothes were taken, their luggage was taken, they were given prison uniforms. Back then, they were orange jumpsuits. And they lived there under, there's about 40 men in a room living on cots, sleeping on cots. And in the same area where they have their cots, they have bathroom facilities that are exposed. Right next to it are the telephones and eating tables. And there's a television suspended from the ceiling in the same area. And this is the place where 40 men, live and sleep and eat and talk to their lawyers on the telephone every day. It's been about 4 years now that these two men have been detained. They lived in those conditions for about 3 years and then were transferred, both of them, to a prison, the York County prison in Pennsylvania. One of them, Victor, actually transferred again and then back again. But they've seen prison, a regular prison, and they've seen an immigration detention center. And when you talk to them, comparisons are quite interesting because in the prison they could see through a window, they could see outside. They were given some recreation time. Although they were with prisoners, they were treated to some degree like they had, they say more humanely, that like they were people. And here at the detention center, they complain of the treatment along with all the other inmates at this, the other detainees at this facility, none of whom have done anything wrong, yet it's called a private correctional facility. And they joke, what are they correcting about us? They stay in this detention center for years. And Victor and Alexei, surprisingly, were actually released on parole as part of an agreement about a year ago. It was a year and a half ago. It was in August 2002. They were released as part of their appeals process. And when they went in back to, they kept reporting back for their court hearings back in New York, even though they were living in Pennsylvania. And each time they came back to New York for their hearing, they would go through the process and return back to their jobs and their the place where they were volunteering at hospitals. On their last hearing in June, when they returned, the judge granted them relief that they were hoping for, which was withholding of removal under the Convention Against Torture, which in another convention that we're party to, which means that, we swear that we won't ever send anybody back to a place where they might be getting tortured. And the immigration judge granted them that relief. Now, the attorney in the case, the government's attorney, said, I might want to appeal that decision. I might want to challenge this and see if we can get them deported. And so while I'm making my decision, I want them re-detained. And the judge actually said to the gentleman, I have no control over this, and you have to, do as she says. And so they were re-detained. And they've been there now since June. It's been about 7 months now. And this puts all together, you know, all together, it's been about 4 years that they've been detained. And they've seen America. They've lived here. They've been responsible citizens. I mean, sorry, not citizens. They've been responsible immigrants and enjoyed the protection that we've offered them and tried to give back to the community. And instead, you know, we reward them by putting them back in detention. This phenomenon of detaining people after they've already been given relief by a judge is something that has always been a possibility because, like I said, detention is totally at the whim of the immigration officers. It's always been a possibility, but it is another effect that we're seeing of, you know, post 9/11, post Department of Homeland Security changes. This is happening to many people around the country. There's another woman we profile in the report who's a nun from Tibet. And, you know, she was persecuted in Tibet because of her desire to practice her religion and came to the United States and was detained much in the same way. And after about 6 months was given asylum by the judge, the full, you know, asylum grant, everything that she could possibly hope for. And now, after winning asylum, could be on the road to becoming a citizen. But instead, you know, she faces, when the day that she was granted asylum, the immigration officer said, the immigration attorney said, I might want to appeal this, and re-detained her. And so now she continues to be in detention, even though she already has asylum. These are all people who have had several parole applications put in. All of their applications have been denied by immigration officers. All of the reasons have been suspect. In other words, there are very few reasons. Victor and Alexei from the Ukraine, their parole denial actually said, for the above reasons, which didn't really reference any reason, we don't want to release her from detention, referring to the gentleman as women. These obviously there isn't a whole lot of thought that the immigration officers are putting into whether to release these folks. Now, this decision, unfortunately, is not appealable to a judge. That's one of the major things that we're trying to achieve by this report and by our current campaign, what we're asking people to join us in trying to urge the government to do, is to at least create a safeguard for those asylum seekers who are subject to detention, to say that if they're detained and they meet the government's own criteria for release, that if the immigration officer says they don't want to release them, at least one could go to a judge and ask for a reconsideration. That's the type of due process that, you know, any human is really entitled to in the world, and we should be giving that to our asylum seekers here.
All right, well, thank you for joining us, and thanks for the work you're doing.
Thank you so much.
I've been speaking with Archie Piotti, who is a lawyer with the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, which is just rechristens itself Human Rights First, and we'll be back after this word from Lou Reed.
Room costs $2,000 a month. You can believe it, man, it's true. Somewhere a landlord's laughing till he wets his pants. No one dreams of being a doctor or a lawyer or anything. They dream of dealing on the dirty boulevard. Give me your hungry, you're tired, you're poor, I'll piss on them. That's what the statue of bigotry says. Your poor huddled masses, let's club them to death. And get it over with and just dump them on the boulevard. Get them out on the dirty boulevard. Going out to the dirty boulevard. They're going down on the dirty boulevard. Going out. Outside, it's a bright night. There's an opera at Lincoln Center. Movie stars arrive by limousine. The Klieg lights shoot up over the skyline of Manhattan. But the lights are out on the mean streets. A small kid stands by the Lincoln Tunnel. He's selling plastic roses for a park. The traffic's backed up to 39th Street.
And that was an excerpt from Lou Reed's 1989 song, I think, Dirty Boulevard, from his album New York. And this is WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM on the radio dial and on the web at WBAI.org. And remember, that fundraiser is coming up. I'll have more words about the end of the show, but please... exercise your check writing or pledge making fingers in preparation for that very important fundraiser next week, starting next week. And now we're joined on the line by Satya Gabriel, who is a professor of economics at Mount Holyoke College. Welcome to WBAI.
Thank you, Doug. Good evening.
Good evening to you. Thanks for joining us. Well, China is on the economic scene right now, a maze of contradictions. It seems to be booming massively, yet spreading deflation around the world, and it seems like creating enormously rising incomes at the same time. It's creating unemployment across across China. It seems like this, on one hand, this massive capitalist success story, and on the other hand, a still communist state. How can we understand all these contradictions? What is going on in China right now?
Well, first, let me say that I don't really think China is causing deflation around the world. I think it may, in fact, be doing the opposite. There are really two economies that are driving global growth at this point. One is the United States economy, and the other is China. One of the reasons I think that there is this conception that China is spreading deflation is the idea that the Chinese currency is undervalued and should actually increase in value. Indicate that it's a growing economy, that it's a more powerful economy than it has been. It's pegged to the U.S. dollar and has been since 1994. And the argument is that they're manipulating the currency by keeping it pegged. I think, in fact, the reality is that, as you pointed out yourself, it's a great success story in terms of economic growth. A lot of new wealth has been generated over the last 25 years. China's economy has grown far faster than anyone could have predicted. In fact, I think most Western economists believe China was incapable of even coming close to the level of growth that we're seeing today, and the growth is real. Now, that's one part of the story. The other part of the story that was implied in what you said is that there's also the growing income inequality and growing unemployment in China. That's also true. Unemployment today in China is something around 300 million people if you include the underemployed in that. That's more than the population of the United States. There's also growing income inequality in China. There's been an enormous change in the amount of income inequality over the last 20-plus years. China has gone from one of the countries with one of the most equal distributions of income to one of those with one of the most unequal income distributions in just 20 years, and however you measure it, Gini coefficients and so on. So all of that's true. Let me tell you very briefly why I think it's not deflationary, though. The reason is that unemployment in China would be far worse than it is if it was not for the fact that the Chinese government continues to subsidize industry, in particular those industries that still have a significant amount of state ownership. This is one of the catalysts for domestic economic growth in China. That domestic growth is actually resulting in fairly sizable increases in imports into China. And therefore, it's helping other economies, including the U.S. economy, by basically providing this market for incremental growth in output. China has also been very active in the U.S. Treasury market. It's, in fact, one of the leading participants in U.S. Treasury markets globally, and has helped to keep U.S. interest rates low, which has helped the U.S. economy to stay strong. In fact, during the period that we just went through, we seem to be getting out of this recessionary period, although we can't be quite sure just yet because a lot of war spending is in that. But nevertheless, we seem to be getting out of that. But during that period, China was a key factor in generating the growth in the housing market in the U.S. by buying U.S. Treasury bonds, driving up U.S. Treasury prices, and driving down U.S. interest rates. It wasn't just the Fed. You would have to say that the People's Bank of China was a partner with the Fed in that regard. That resulted in more spending taking place in the U.S. economy than would be happening otherwise, which has helped the global economy, global economic systems all over the world. So China has played both a direct role in terms of the imports into China and an indirect role by helping the U.S. economy. If China stopped subsidizing its domestic industry, that domestic demand in China would dry up. China's economic growth machine would slow down at least, perhaps even go in reverse, and consequently you'd have far more far more unemployed people in China. The exports, the imports into China would stop or would go down dramatically under those circumstances. And in fact, what you would have is a slowdown in global growth if that took place. So part of what I'm arguing is that China's driving growth, not deflation. China's currency is not really overvalued, but I think it may, in fact, be undervalued because of the subsidization of Chinese industry that's causing the domestic demand growth. I just gave you a mouthful, so I'm going to let you
Try that here. That was all an important mouthful, though. Well, I think what a lot of concerns a lot of people in the United States, of course, but not just in the United States and other rich countries, but even in countries like Mexico, is that they're being put out of business. Manufacturing workers are being thrown out of jobs. Companies are being thrown out of business because China's costs are so low. You know, they got workers paid 10 cents an hour. Unions are essentially illegal. What do you say?
Part of what I'm arguing is that you're right, but you're right about Mexico more so than about the United States. China's not competing with the United States. I don't think a lot of people are standing in line for jobs making toys in the United States or shirts, but, you know, there are still, you know, some textile manufacturing going on in the U.S. and it's largely protected. Mexico is a different case altogether. Mexico, you know, Thailand, a number of other countries that are in that kind of middle category of economic growth, they're competing with China. And in that case, you're right. China has a very low-cost labor force. But that low-cost labor force would be even lower cost if the Chinese government stopped subsidizing Chinese industry. They could float their currency, stop subsidizing industry, and the Chinese currency would end up would go down relative to the U.S. dollar rather than go up because of the effect of, you know, dropping the subsidization of that industry.
I'm speaking with Satya Gabriel, who is a professor of economics at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts and finishing up a book on the Chinese economy right now. Well, there are also a lot of people who look at China and say, "This, whatever may happen to China in the long term," and I want to turn to that towards the end of this interview, but, you know, whatever may happen in the longer term, in the short to medium term, it looks like a boom is just out of control, and you've got a financial system that looks overextended and very rickety, and it just looks like a country cruising for a bust. What do you say to that?
Well, that's possible for any economy, especially any capitalist economy, and part of the argument of the book that I'm writing is that China has gone through a transition from being what I describe as a state feudal economy. You can forget the word communist because there's virtually no communism in China and never has been. But we understand feudalism to be a system in which people are forced to work for a particular lord. They used to have to work for the state. The state was the lord. So it was state feudalism. They've made a transition from that to first state capitalism, where there's lots of choice of employers and the state's one of them, to now private capitalism. And almost any private capitalist economy can be said to be fragile because the very nature of capitalism is flexibility. There's flexibility about employing, how many workers are employed. There's flexibility about whether to invest or not. These decisions are made by boards of directors of lots of decentralized corporations. And so by the very nature of that, there are fragilities in that system. There's potential for crisis in that system. And China isn't any different in that regard. Although every country has its own mechanisms for either making that better or making that worse. Now, having said that, you mentioned the financial sector. The financial problems in China are basically of a domestic nature. They're similar to Japan in that there's a lot of debt, and although less today than there was when this crisis or when this problem was first identified in the international community, there's a lot of debt in the state owned firms in particular, the big industrial firms, and that debt is denominated in the domestic currency, in renminbi, in the yuan. Now, that's similar to Japan in that there's lots of debt in the big keiretsu in Japan, but it's denominated in yen rather than in U.S. dollars or some other foreign currency. And in some sense, that makes the problem a lot easier to handle because it's possible then, I mean, you don't have foreign debtors who are demanding payment, and you run into problems being able to import necessary, you know, inputs, technology, and so on because of not having the hard currency. China has a kind of almost the opposite problem because, like Japan, they've got a lot of hard currency. They can buy a lot of things from us and from other foreign countries. They can, they're also investing in foreign markets, including in the U.S. and increasingly with their hard currency. And the domestic problem of the debt is one that they're handling in a way similar to the way we handle the savings and loan problems that we had in the 1980s. They basically created, and they've got four state management, asset management companies that are buying this debt from the banks, in particular the four big state banks, which have most of the non-performing loans. They're buying that debt with the intention of reselling it. Now, I don't know who wants to buy it, so I don't know where they're going to sell it, but what it's doing is reliquifying the banks, which means the banks are then back in a position to lend again. And that, in fact, is what that's the kind of problem you have. When you have a financial meltdown, what typically happens is that if the amount of non-performing loans is great enough, it creates a liquidity problem for the banks, and the banks can't lend. And if banks can't lend, investment goes down, the economy goes down. Even more firms are unable to pay on their loans, and so the crisis just gets worse. China's actually avoiding that problem by doing what we did and what a number of other countries have done, including Mexico when it had, as part of its way out of its financial crisis, by removing those non-performing loans from the bank balance sheet. By doing that, banks can once again lend, and they are doing so at a fairly rapid rate. That actually is more worrisome to me than the non-performing loans from the past. It's the current rate of lending is increasing, and a lot of those loans are going to property, to real estate. And real estate loans, that's, as you probably know, that was at the root of the crisis in Thailand, which started the whole Asian economic crisis of 1997-98. And so I'm more concerned about the current wave of lending than I am about that past wave of lending, because I think that's being dealt with. Now, whether the state is able to find buyers for it again, I don't know. They're talking about trying to sell it to foreign financial firms, but you know, I don't know too many foreign financial firms that are beating down the doors trying to buy, you know, non-performing loans in China.
Well, at 5 cents of the dollar, you could probably find some speculator to buy just about anything.
That's probably true.
Let's talk about the kinds of the levels of sophistication the Chinese economy is operating at. One of the things that, for example, Korea or even Japan a generation earlier was very successful at was like starting at the low end of the industrial food chain and then gradually moving up the ladder to more and more sophisticated, complicated, and high-value items. Where is China in that process?
China has not yet reached the level of a South Korea. There are not a lot of high-tech firms in China. If you go around and you look for them, you're not going to find very many. China is trying to fill that gap partly by buying outside of China, buying firms that have the technology. Because that's the big issue. I mean, the Communist Party of China, if anything, their focus is on getting technology and on improving technology. And I think that's been the case for many, many years. It was the idea was embodied in the phrase four modernizations, where they wanted to modernize industry, agriculture, research and development, and the military. And more recently, it's become embodied in Jiang Zemin's three represents, where he said the party represents advanced technology, advanced culture, and a majority of the people. Well, I don't know about the last of those or the middle one, but clearly they are focused on trying to get their hands on advanced technology. That's part of why the success of getting the hard currency is so important. Nevertheless, they haven't achieved that yet. They're moving in that direction. It's a very big country. And I think part of the problem for China, and maybe it's not so much of a problem for China, but for the rest of the world, is that there, to some degree, I think the growth is actually far stronger than people realize, because people don't think about how big China is. China has 1.3 billion people, and so it's been growing at almost double-digit rates for over 20 years. No, it hasn't transformed itself into some gigantic version of South Korea, but the very fact that it's on the verge of that is itself transformative for the whole world. And I think ultimately that's really the key for us. Is if we pay attention to, we really should pay attention to what's going on in China, because it is, as I think I told you in a previous conversation with you over email, I see what's going on in China as being comparable to what happened with Britain and the Industrial Revolution.
I want to return to that in a second, but just one more question about domestic things. It's clear that China is generating a whole army of new unemployed and also a smaller army of new rich. Are there people in the middle who are actually getting into the growth action, or is this a very badly distributed kind of growth?
It's very badly distributed, but at the same time, there is a what you might describe as a middle class growing in China. There are increasing numbers. Of course, again, we're talking about, in absolute terms, or talking about a lot of people. In relative terms, not a lot of people who are in managerial positions or otherwise connected to the growth in, private enterprises and more autonomous state enterprises, foreign enterprises. They have fairly good incomes, live in ways that would not be something that would be unfamiliar to someone living in an American city. If you go to Shanghai or Guangzhou, the middle class living in those cities, they have they now have automobiles and luxury apartments and cell phones. So there are a large number of people who are living that life. But at the same time, as I said before, income inequality has grown faster in China than I don't know any other country where income inequality has grown as fast as it has in China.
And then finally, we've only got a couple of minutes left, but what you're saying that the impact in the outside world is going to be enormous and we should really pay attention. So could you amplify that on that for a minute or two?
Well, it's changing. It's going to change the power alignments in the world. China's already there's already an enormous amount of clout that China has in the international community of transnational corporations, whether they be financial or industrial. Everybody wants to get into China. Everybody wants to have offices in China. The Chinese government Chinese government's enjoying growing clout in this community. On the other hand, you can also say that that community is increasing its clout inside government in China, both at the local levels and at the national level. China is becoming integrated into this global, you might describe it as a global capitalist economy, in ways that will give it increasing influence over the shape of how that economy grows and changes over time. It's eventually going to be a serious competitor with the United States, and as both in terms of cultural influence and economic influence and political influence. So in that sense, I think that certainly we're going to have to rethink the way things happen in the future. At the moment, the United States enjoys being the only real superpower in the world. And I think that's something that we shouldn't get too comfortable with, because it's going to change. There's no question it will change.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us.
You're quite welcome, Doug.
Satya Gabriel, who teaches economics at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts and is writing a book on China and its economy for Routledge. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week with my fundraising special, the star of which will be Noam Chomsky, in an interview I'm going to record tomorrow and edit it early next week. And you'll hear parts of it about his new book and many other matters as well, and other guests to be announced. So stay tuned for the news, and on into the evening. I'll be back next week, I think from 3 to 6, so a long, long period of listening to me and begging and such. So stay tuned for the news, and let's go out with this old favorite from Chicks on Speed.
Hi, my name is Julie. I like Mac power books and electronic music.
Wanna be the ruler of the galaxy.
Wanna be the king of the universe.
Let's meet and have a baby.
Galaxy.
Of the Enterprise.